From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. In yet another week of dramatic and historic events, the House Judiciary Committee held impeachment hearings, after which U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asked the chairman of the Democratic-led House Committee to proceed with articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump, declaring that he has, quote, abused the power of his office, unquote. NATO's just Secretary General insisted that good progress was made at a meeting of the alliance in London to mark its 70th anniversary this week, as leaders reaffirmed their commitment to collective self-defense against any Russian aggression. But as has been seen before, President Trump's interactions with European leaders dominated the news from London. The United States and North Korea engaged in a series of alluded threats of force against each other ahead of Pyongyang's end-of-year deadline for progress with nuclear negotiations. And California Senator Kamala Harris, who had once been a leading challenger for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination, suspended her campaign. Panelists, welcome. Again, as I say, it's been a week of drama, history, gravitas in every possible way. But at the end of the day, Speaker Pelosi's request that the articles of impeachment be drawn up all but ensured that President Trump will be just the third U.S. president to face a trial in the Senate for the possibility of removal from office. And again, for our audience, I want to remind you that impeachment is basically, in this process, a synonym for indictment. It is not removal. Impeachment leads to a trial, which could lead to removal from office. I'll start with you, Kim. Did we learn anything new in the Judiciary Committee's hearing? Was there additional evidence that was brought forward that will be evident in the articles of impeachment that are being drawn up?
The Judiciary Committee hearings were less about presenting new evidence and more sort of laying the groundwork for what is necessary for impeachment. They brought in a bunch of constitutional scholars to talk in great detail about what the writers of the U.S. Constitution and the other documents around it had in mind when they came up with the idea of impeachment, what sort of meets that bar and what does not. And there's been this idea really pushed by the Democrats and backed up by a lot of the evidence that because President Trump did, by all the evidence we've seen thus far, put pressure on Ukraine's president to investigate one of his domestic political rivals in exchange for aid or for a meeting, that either amounts to bribery or an undue use or an illegal use of his power, which is what the Democrats are arguing. Now, there were three scholars on the hearing panel brought in by the Democrats who basically made that argument that that's definitely grounds for impeachment. That's definitely what the founders had in mind. One scholar said that the Democrats haven't quite taken enough steps to get there.
Jonathan, and let's talk about those scholars. I think you know maybe one, if not all of those people. Jonathan Turley, who's the one who was brought in by the Republicans, who had previously been a very pro-impeachment scholar, if you will, for other proceedings. Did any minds get changed with people sitting on the committee or with the citizens watching at home?
I think that is probably the most fascinating aspect of this. I mean, I look at this impeachment drama as having three levels. And the first level is constitutional, whether Trump committed actions that warrant impeachment. Just in my own view, the Democrats make a very compelling case that he did. The second level is political, and it's a battle basically between the Democrats and the Republicans, particularly the Democrats, to try to bring Republicans over to their side so that this becomes a bipartisan exercise. On that level, I think the Republicans are kicking the stuffing out of the Democrats. That not one Republican has broken ranks to join in the Democratic push for impeachment. The third level is a struggle for public opinion. And I would say that on that level, it's basically 50-50, if not a little bit more to the Republicans' favor. Mm-hmm. Americans are not as tuned in to this drama as we all are inside Washington. They are concerned about basically pocketbook issues. And there are some Democrats that it's very interesting to pay attention to them. A guy like Max Rose, who represents Brooklyn, New York, South Brooklyn and
exactly.
Staten Island.
Okay.
Right. He was against impeachment, actually writing an op-ed the day before the whistleblower revealed the whole Ukraine situation. And he was asked whether he still was against impeachment now, just a few days ago. What he basically said was, my concerns, which are my constituents care about guns, about infrastructure, about the high cost of drugs and the opioid epidemic. That's what their real concerns are, not the impeachment. That's what they still care about. And he has not decided yet whether he wants to support impeachment.
And Kim, I know that there's a number of Democrats that Jonathan is talking about. And these are freshmen who won in contested districts. That is, districts where Trump won. But now you had a Democrat who won in the last midterm elections. Mm-hmm. Speaker Pelosi has said politics don't matter, though. She said that this is a matter of honor and duty. So I guess you could just respond to what Jonathan said and then take up the cause of why this is the right thing to do. Not necessarily the cause, but what are the argument for that?
Well, it's interesting you're talking about this member of Congress who is opposed to it because it wasn't what Americans cared about. Remember, up until very recently, Speaker Pelosi was against impeachment. She was doing these big splashy news interviews and in the biggest magazines and newspapers here saying this is not what we need to be focused on. We have a great agenda heading into the 2020 election. Democrats are going to continue the blue wave from the midterms into 2020. Let's not get caught up on impeachment. And then that whistleblower complaint came out.
Right.
And then there was this just tide and wave of evidence that the president had been using his influence abroad to try to affect one of his domestic political candidates. And Pelosi said that she just could not stand for it. And I think you really saw some of that emotion and that sense of duty when she came out in her press conference saying that this was what she and the Democrats had to do effectively to preserve the democracy. And you had people pushing back on her in the press conference saying, oh, you hate President Trump. And she had a visceral reaction to it, saying, you know, she's Catholic and she doesn't hate anyone, that this isn't about politics. Now, to your point about those vulnerable Democrats, that was definitely a major political calculus as to why Speaker Pelosi did not want to pursue impeachment in the past. However, I do think there is a little bit of that sort of moral dimension for many of the Democrats. I imagine they had a bit of a look at history and wanted to think about how they were going to be remembered at this time and what they did and did not allow. And I also think that Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats believe that even if they lose a couple of seats as a result of this, it may be, you know, worth it in the long run to have at least had themselves on the record on this.
So let's talk a little bit about timetable, because the White House has a very limited time to say whether it's going to participate in anything else that's going on in the Judiciary Committee. Also, the last legislative day as December 20th, there's a thought that there are going to be articles of impeachment written and voted on December 20th. So I think that's the timetable we're looking at, even though people swear that there's no timetable. It looks like probably that's what it is. Jonathan, I'll let you close with this, or start to close with this. What are those articles of impeachment likely to include? Because we've had this evidence that's come from the whistleblower on the Ukraine situation, but we also have all this information from the Mueller report, where in that report they basically laid out other articles, potential articles, based on obstruction of justice. Are those going to be roped into that indictment too?
We don't know for certain, but what we're looking at, I think, is definitely a article of impeachment for bribery, a second one for abuse of power, a third one for obstruction of Congress, and possibly obstruction of justice. And the obstruction of justice article would refer to the Mueller investigation and the obstruction of justice in that case. So that's basically what we're looking at. One thing I'd like to just point out, though, is that the White House has basically refused to recognize this entire process.
Yes.
And they are not going kind of rebuttal on the House side. They are going to make their case in the Senate, where the Senate is controlled by the Republicans, and in all likelihood, given the fact that no Republicans have broken ranks, he will be acquitted, and President Trump's future will be decided by the election.
It looks like that's the case, and we're just about out of time on this particular subject, but I will say that we'll have a trial in the Senate. Senators are not allowed to speak, as they famously say, on pain of imprisonment. It'll be interesting to watch all those senators sit silent while this whole trial is going on, and I think that there will be some reckoning for the senators who vote one way or the other. There is a political price to pay necessarily for if you vote yay or nay, especially if other witnesses come forward and add to this sort of pile of evidence that Democrats are creating, circumstantial or no. Let's move on to NATO. Again, the Secretary General made statements about how the NATO alliance is still strong, still useful, still purposeful. Yes, cue the background music. I'll start with you, Jonathan. Is the state of the alliance still strong? Is it still strong, still purposeful?
I would say not as strong as Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg portrayed it. NATO has very, very serious structural issues. It really depends on geographically where each country sits. So, for example, France, which is trying to claim the mantle of leadership of Western Europe.
The post-Merkel era, let's
exactly,
say.
Right. Is basically saying that the biggest issue is terrorism, both in the Middle East, in North Africa, and in the Sahel, the countries just below North Africa,
yeah.
Mali, Niger, and in France itself. I mean, there have been a number of attacks by Islamic State inside France.
Right.
That, for him, is the biggest issue. And he actually confronted President Trump on this during their impromptu press conference.
Very contentious.
Very, very contentious, yeah. Moment. Germany, for example, feels that that is not the case. And Poland, particularly the countries in the East, feel that Russia is the biggest issue. And Turkey, which is a real disruptor now, wants all NATO countries, all 29 of them, to recognize the Syrian Kurds as terrorists.
As terrorists.
As terrorists. And they, of course, were U.S. allies in fighting against the Islamic State. So there's that. A second issue is France really does not trust the United States leadership anymore under Trump, and he feels that this is not just a temporary thing, this is structural, and that Europe has to take more responsibility for its own security,
yeah.
What they call strategic autonomy. Basically, that Europe has to develop its own army to replace the United States.
Which is an interesting strategy, because one of the points is that, number one, trade partners don't shoot at each other, and if the United States spreads that umbrella of protection, you don't have to build up armies which you would potentially point at each other in a continental war. So it seems as though that sort of idea may be crumbling. Actually, we'll take up this issue about Trump and NATO right after we take this break. We'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Kimberly, we were talking about NATO. And just picking up on what Jonathan was talking about.
Right, and the divisions within NATO, particularly between France and Germany, you had quite a butting of heads in the last month or so, in particular between French President Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel in Germany over an interview that he did, where he was talking about sort of not being able to rely on the United States and that we need to sort of go it on our own. And she was really upset with him.
This was the brain dead interview.
Yes, the brain dead interview, saying that NATO was having a brain death as a result of all of these differences and America sort of receding into the background. And Merkel's like, what are you doing? This is not helpful. But on the other hand, it's interesting you brought up sort of the purpose of NATO to have the standing army to protect itself in unison. And I think it's particularly galling for Macron and others that the United States is the only one that's ever used that function within NATO to call upon its allies to come to its common defense. But yes, as I think you were about to pick up, Trump looms large over NATO.
Stay with it. I'll stay with you on that one. So we have Trump, again, seemingly worried more about the accounts receivable part of NATO rather than the
That's all he worries about.
The features and benefits. I'll give it to you and then go to you, Jonathan. I mean, I guess my question is, can this alliance survive Donald Trump? And we will have another president after Donald Trump in the United States. Is U.S. receding from that alliance sort of the death knell for U.S. leadership in it? Will the alliance turn to some other either singular figure or some other combination of figures to provide moral and actual leadership.
I think that's been happening pretty consistently since Trump came to office.
During the administration.
I mean, there was that very famous meeting where they were supposed to all get together to celebrate, what is it, Article 4, I believe. Article 5, thank you, about the mutual defense agreement. And Trump was just like, meh, maybe. After that point, you saw sort of, particularly the European members of NATO just saying, okay, let's reevaluate, let's rebalance, let's make sure that we've got our own. It's interesting. President Trump is very open about the fact that he views these relationships as transactional and not necessarily thinking about the larger picture. It's, I can do this for you. What can you do for me? And I don't think he hides that this is how he sees these relationships. He prefers bilateral relationships to multilateral relationships. At the same time, this trip was supposed to be a win for Trump. You know, the president was heading over to Europe, ready to sort of tout his accomplishments, what he claims his accomplishment in convincing the recalcitrant members of NATO to put more money in. And NATO contributions have been going up, and President Trump has been consistent at putting pressure on countries to contribute more to the defense forces. And so he was ready to go over there and sort of shout from the rooftops that this was one of his accomplishments, hopefully to present a counter narrative to those hearings that were happening in the House at the same time.
Right.
Quite work out that way.
Didn't quite work out that way. And I mean, sort of like glossing over sort of the, I don't know, sort of the catty nature of, you know, the comments caught on tape and that sort of thing. And that sort of thing happens probably at every NATO conference, at every conference, really. If you had an open mic, you could hear some disparaging remarks being said about everyone. So there's no reason necessarily to sit on that. But there's a certain lack of respect, it seems, for the president of the United States. And again, I'll ask you and throw you the same question. Does that lack of respect for the United States make it a much weaker and less effective alliance and a deterrent, which is it's what it's meant to be?
I think that the lack of respect isn't so much for the president of the United States as a institution. It's a lack of respect for Trump. I mean, Trump came to office basically saying the whole world is laughing at us. And under my leadership, that's going to stop. No one's going to laugh at us anymore. And there you saw this video with a hot mic of world leaders laughing at Trump. They were laughing at him. And he was supposed to give, it's very customary for the President of the United States as the leader of NATO to give a final news conference where all the accomplishments or problems are discussed and made public in this news conference.
Yeah.
Trump, after having heard about this video, basically fled. He canceled the news conference and flew back to the United States. So to a certain degree, it appeared like he had his tail between his legs. Mm. Now, you ask the question, is this going to continue after Trump? I would tend to say that the withdrawal of the United States from a position of world leadership as a result of Trump is not going to be so easily restored. We're going to have a new president, and if it's a Democrat, there's going to be an attempt to restore that position of leadership. But that doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
So that's why Macron is saying that this is structural, and that's why Europe has to basically look after its own security.
I'll let you finish on this one.
Yeah, I completely agree that it is going to take more than just one cycle to repair the damage that has been done to American leadership on the global stage. And if and when it comes back, I don't think it's going to look the same, because what's been happening in the meantime is in this vacuum created by the retreat of the United States in this space and us taking a more isolationist position is that Russia and China have been able to grow their influence almost unchecked. And I think this is why you see Angela Merkel and Poland very concerned about Russia in NATO and Emmanuel Macron concerned about terrorism. These are both areas in which the U.S. used to lead and now has retreated. And in the meantime, on the global economic scale, because marketplaces is what we pay attention to all the time, China is really taking over sort of the global economic narrative.
Yeah. So as they say, nature and politics, I would say.
Abhors a vacuum.
Abhors a vacuum.
And you could also say the enemy gets a vote.
Very well said.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the U.S. and North Korea. The United States and North Korea are sort of starting this war of words and name-calling. Look, there is a deadline for a deal with North Korea regarding their nuclear program, their missile testing, all of these things. We've been promised a deal. Talks have been said to be going well. Jonathan, I'll throw this to you. Are there talks going on? Is anyone from the State Department talking to anyone from North Korea? And is there any idea of what a deal actually looks like?
The answer to your first question is no, there are no talks going on. Trump appeared to change the whole dynamic of U.S.-North Korean relations by going and meeting with Kim three different times. And that raised a lot of expectations, not only in the international community, but particularly in North Korea. The North Koreans basically want to trade their nuclear weapons for huge economic benefits. They want to do this gradually. They want to do this step by step. They don't want to do this the way John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, basically said, North Korea has to give up everything, and then we will consider lifting sanctions and giving economic benefits. That's not what the North Koreans want, and they've stuck by that.
The president's ego is caught up in it a bit as well, because every single time this happens, you know, the people in the know about North Korea are saying, the North Koreans are stringing you along, you're not going to get anything, this is just how they play the game. And Trump comes back and says, no, I'm going to get to a deal. I like this guy. He and I get along. We're going to work something out. And each time it fails. And so now the president of the United States is almost at a disadvantage to the leader of North Korea in that he has something to prove. Whereas Kim Jong-un is obviously in very good shape with his people because he's a dictator.
Let's talk a little bit about Kamala Harris. She's a California senator who had started very strongly her campaign announcement. I believe there were more than 20,000 people at her campaign launch. She had her signature moment, and I believe it was the first debate where she talked about busing and had a direct conflict with the leader in the polls, Joe Biden, that gave him a tick down and gave her a tremendous boost up, made her, I believe, number two in the polls in that week. Then the air seemed to come out of the balloon. Kimberly, what happened?
The air just kind of went out of it. A couple of things happened. In the last week or so, I should say, there were lots and lots of reports in the media to the level that many called it a hit job, that there were fractures within her campaign, that it was disorganized, that people were leaving, that they were running out of money, and they were short on cash. This is a very crowded field, and the money question was always going to be a big deciding factor.
And she said, I'm not a billionaire, in her statement announcing that she was suspending. I'm not a billionaire, and we have, what, four, maybe five billionaires?
Right. You have people like Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg who are literally, if you want to believe the pundits, buying their way into the polling numbers. Yeah. They have enough money in their own pockets to run ads to get the name recognition necessary to sort of be a meaningful role in the race. But anyway, for the Harris campaign, she was stuck in a very difficult position. She had a record as a criminal prosecuting attorney that didn't exactly play very well to a lot of the sort of progressive wings that were ascendant in the Democratic field. She also was trying to position herself against more centrist moderate Democrats that were a little bit better known. And then I do believe the fact that she is a black woman mattered, because there is a sense, first of all, Joe Biden has a ton of support among African Americans, a lot of them just believing that the segment of the American population that the Democrats need to win in order to beat Trump would not vote for a black woman. And so there's this sort of complicated racial and gender dynamics at play, in addition to just not having enough money and having not necessarily as clear a message about where she stood in the campaign compared to some of the other candidates.
Jonathan, we got about 2 minutes. Let you finish up the last one.
I think that last point that you made, Kimberly, is very, very important. She wasn't a particularly strong candidate. She couldn't really articulate a clear message. I mean, when you're running for president, you have to be able to say why you're running and what you want to do. And her message wasn't very, very clear on this. Another point that I'd like to make, the candidates who have focused mostly on identity politics and on social justice have been the weakest in this race. As you said, it's a crowded field, but look who's fallen out. The candidates who stressed social justice and identity politics, Kirsten Gillibrand, that was the theme of her campaign. Beto O'Rourke, also what people would call a very woke candidate. He's gone. And now Kamala Harris. I think what's happening is that the priority for Democratic voters is to beat Trump. And issues of social justice and identity politics take a back seat to considerations of who would be the strongest candidate to beat Trump. And as you mentioned, Kimberly, Joe Biden, a 77-year-old white man, has most of the support of the black community. You would think
the older black community.
The older black community, yes.
That is all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor to Newsweek. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.